I'm Roy Sharples, and welcome to the Unknown Origins podcast. Why are you listening to this podcast? Are you an industry expert looking for insights? Are you growing your career? Or are you a dear friend helping to spur your pal on? I created the Unknown Origins podcast to have the most inspiring conversations with creative industry personalities and experts about entrepreneurship, pop culture, art, music, film, and fashion. Richard Harper is the author of 14 books, including the IEEE award-winning The Myth of the Paperless Office and Texture, the AOIR Book of the Year in 2011. And Skyping the Family in 2019. He has also published over 200 scientific and has 27 patents. His research looks at how people engage with each other through technology and the implications for engineering and concepts of the individual in the digital age. His research is thus directly pertinent to the topic of digital exclusion. He is director of the Institute of Social Futures at Lancaster University, which coheres humanities and social science research with natural and physical sciences and engineering. He is a fellow of the IET, the Royal Society of Arts, and ACM Fellow. The bulk of his career has been spent in commercial research, Xerox, and Microsoft in particular. Hello and welcome, Richard. What inspired and attracted you to research in the first place?
I think what inspired me to do research was when I was at university, one of the professors in the second year at university taught me some arguments about what was called the nuclear family. And he was talking about social theory, which is not interesting to lots of people, but he was saying that lots of social theorists say that in capitalism, modern industry, made everyone live in so-called nuclear families, little families. And it all seemed very plausible. And he taught a whole term on how nuclear families allowed us to allow people to have, you know, men folk go out to work where the mother would stay at home and look after children, and how they kind of created a social structure. And then in the second term, he said, this implies there was a time when there wasn't a nuclear family. And when we kind of assumed that, you know, before capitalism, there wasn't a nuclear family, he said, well, let's have a look. And so he reported some anthropological researchers who found the only continuous parish records of family life in Europe going back to the 12th century, and that's in Nottingham. And there they found that there's never been any recorded instance for nearly 1,000 years of anything other than a nuclear family in England. That families have always argued. Mothers don't like daughter-in-laws. Father-in-laws don't like son-in-laws. And that what tends to happen is families end up quite small. Mum and dad and a few kids, and families struggle. And they struggled in medieval Nottingham, just as they struggled in Victorian England. And what was interesting to me about this wasn't the sociology of it. Was because I'd assumed, I just took it for granted that I understood things like things were different before the Industrial Revolution. And what the professor made me realize was there are lots of things we take for granted, but actually the joy of research is deepening your understanding and realizing that things that you took for granted were not as you imagined. And then and if you allow yourself to see things differently, it's not that you become more knowledgeable, you have more facts in your head. It's actually that you can see things better and understand things more clearly. So for want of analogy, if you're mining for ideas and you're really excited and you've been well trained, you know where to dig and you know how to get deeper quicker through research. And that's the thing I learned from and got excited about research was the capacity of the realization that things I took for granted possibly weren't right, and actually you can investigate them and you could see the world differently. And having seen the world differently, you can get excited about exploring it. And then having explored it, the thing that happened after university when I became a PhD and did my PhD was you could then start thinking about how to make the world differently. And making the world differently, particularly in my era, in the 80s and 90s, through software and through computing. And so you could test your ideas about how what people wanted to do through building programs and little applications and devices. And what you find quite often is the things you build don't do what you thought, but they do other things. And the other things are just as interesting, if not more interesting. So what you learn is research is exciting because you see things more deeply. But then when you're trying to make things, you discover that actually you still don't understand the world that well. But if you're engaged with the world by trying to make things for it, you can make the world different. And that really is the most exciting thing.
Every single creative will tell you that there is no on and off button for creativity. It is a constant that happens naturally, by design, or by accident in our everyday lives. Though the creative process may seem magical, especially where ideas can come from and how they are brought to form and life, there are proven techniques, tools, methods, frameworks, and approaches to the art and science of applied creativity that make it happen, using techniques that drive evolution, synthesis, reapplication, reinvention, reimagination, disruption, revolution, and changing direction. It does not mean being fooled into believing that it is simply about following a process and expecting creative results as an outcome. It is all about people and the execution, because people with a vision combined with passion and drive make things happen. To pursue your idea with conviction and resilience, be skilled in your craft and expedite with quality precision to bring your vision to life. Having true grit to slay the naysayers, to push through adversity and ambiguity with leadership, making sacrifices and execute your ideas in a disciplined way. Richard, how do you find creativity? Do you dream up ideas from within yourself? What you manifest from what you observe from the world around you? Or do ideas fall from the sky and you gravitate towards them? Or is it all of that? In other words, what is your creative process in terms of how do you dream up ideas, develop them into concepts, and then bring them to actualization?
To try and innovate, I think it's best to start by looking at how things are currently done, and that means looking in the real world. Don't theoretically come up with a problem or read about a problem. Go and look at what people are doing, and go and seeing how they're doing it, and then at first spend time trying to see kind of the problems that people are having, and then listen to those sorts of problems. But you mustn't stop there, because the problems that people talk about are often the kinds of the most obvious ones. And often they're the things that can be solved, because that's why people are talking about them. They say, oh, they can't do this. By the end of next week, they probably will have solved it. The deeper problems or the problems that can be solved, you can only get at by having understood the kind of setting in question from the inside, if you like, by listening to what people do and watching what they do. Then you have to look at it slightly oddly, like at a strange angle. And see it slightly differently, like through a funny lens. And one of the things you do when you do that is also try and look at the technology in that setting, because the technology is in all settings, and look at what it doesn't do. Because the trouble with technology is it always seems to be trying to be perfect, doing exactly what it should do, and it should be the perfect tool. And it's sometimes difficult to see what it isn't doing. And one of the things you need to look at is look at the setting strangely, and then look at the technology strangely, and think, what's it not doing? So a sort of good example today is, if you look at meetings, the meeting technologies like Teams, one of the things that Teams is doing, or Zoom, is making meetings. And what are meetings about? Meetings are about sharing information, Meetings are about bringing people together, And sometimes meetings are about bringing people to a room. Now, one of the peculiar things about Teams and Zooms is that it's one of the virtues of computer technology, which is that every meeting you have on Zoom or Teams can be an entirely new meeting. Yeah. But sometimes you want to have a meeting, especially in a kind of creative team, where each week or every 3 days you come back to the same meeting space, and you use the meeting space as a place in which you put your ideas and document them. you kind of make post-it notes and whiteboards and you leave them there. So you come back. So each time you come back, you build on what's happened before. But with current Teams and Zoom meetings, each time you have a meeting, it's a new meeting room. So one of the things you might say about technologies like Zoom and Teams is they're too good at making rooms. Actually, what they want to do sometimes is to allow a room to persist so that every Wednesday, say at 12 o'clock, it's the same meeting room I go to. But also, I can pop into that room at any time and put content in there so that each time I go back and my colleagues go back, the room itself has content. And yeah. Getting to see those sorts of opportunities is basically by looking at what people are doing in meetings and trying to look at the technology that support meetings and trying to see them differently so that you can come up with what are some of the problems you have there and what might be ways of solving it. And oftentimes ways of solving it, for example, the idea that you might have a meeting room that persists. Currently Zoom, for example, provides an audit function so that you can go back and look at the notes that have been made. But what I'm suggesting here is that you want to have a meeting room that you can put stuff in again and again, and then it persists through time. It's not an audit trail. It's rather a virtual entity which lingers. And it's a very simple notion, but it's illustrative of how you can look at meetings in this and understand what's going on in them. And kind of the key thing that's missing currently is that meeting technologies don't allow people to remember very well. They don't necessarily remember what they talked about last time. They don't necessarily remember where they got to in their thinking last time. And one of the things meeting rooms do, real rooms, is let people put their memory on the walls, let people put their memories in notes. So one of the things meeting room technologies like Zoom and Teams should do now is let those sorts of things happen. And that's illustrative of how to think through how to see some creative opportunities. Everyone's very excited about what machine learning and artificial intelligence can do. And it is very exciting and it is very powerful. But there's a big problem with trying to create innovation with artificial intelligence, machine learning tools and technologies is that the people treating AI and machine learning in terms of what you might say is the wrong category. And I mean to say is that what they're wanting AI, machine learning tools and technologies to do is to do what people do, because they think that AI, machine learning, is like a computational version of a human. And so there's all these discussions about the Turing test. Does a machine pass the test of behaving like a human so that a third person couldn't distinguish the two? And to me, that's not very interesting. And also, perhaps much more importantly, it results in people not being as creative with AI and machine learning as they might be, because what they're doing when they're looking at machine learning and AI is thinking about what people are doing and trying to replicate it, rather than thinking that AI and machine learning is a different kind of machinery, a different technology, and thinking what it can do that people can't do, rather than thinking of the new things you could do if you had a new set of tools alongside human tools. You also had AI machine learning tools, which are different to what humans can do. What's tending to happen with AI machine learning with innovation is that it's trying to just do away with people. And so there's a big opportunity that's being missed, which is how can you take those technologies to do different sorts of things that people can't do, and then if you start thinking about what people can't do, what is it that she might want to do with the technology? And I think the exciting thing about machine learning and AI is actually in that direction. And that's going to demand more creativity, because we're so used to tools being designed to let us do things better when the things that we're doing are basically things that we can do anyway. But AI and machine learning technologies could do very different things. They can do things on scale and with data that we can't process.
That's a fine point on artificial intelligence and machine learning being used to do what people do than navigate towards unknown horizons to find the future. That seems to have been a common trait in society, especially in the application of technology. And since the Industrial Revolution, as an example, that was largely about automating human tasks, taking it from what would have been months to days, maybe even hours, minutes. And machines replaced manual labor, which was optimized for time and cost. For example, what Henry Ford did for the assembly line to produce affordable cars for the masses, making it quicker and more convenient for people to get around. Your other point on starting with learning from what already exists historically and today, this helps us understand the world and whatever field domain we are in by providing invaluable lessons, philosophies, stories from which we learn, and it's a starting point for our research. And also, the past has made us who we are today, and understanding history builds better connections and broadens our capacity by allowing us, without sounding corny, to stand on the shoulders of giants and learn from the greats, and then build upon their innovations to ensure that we really are creating something that's new, as opposed to reinventing the wheel through ignorance. History educates us on how society, technology, and governments worked in the past to understand better how we got to the present and how it works now. And it arms us with the arsenal and the insights to create a better way forward. What are the key skills needed to survive and thrive as a researcher?
I think researchers need lots of different key skills, but the kinds of key skills that are important in my research, and my research is about designing tools for people to use at work and at home, are threefold. And the first is you have to be good at desk work. And this sounds obvious, but desk work basically means reading, searching through libraries, going online tools, finding out what's been researched before in that particular space. And, you know, it is just like essay writing. It's just finding out what's been understood. So if you're interested in what people are doing, there are thousands of anthropological studies of human activities, and you will find something to inform you so that when you go to look at the setting in which you want to create innovation, you're already well briefed. And that leads to the second set of skills that a good researcher in my field needs, which is human skills. And human skills, by that I mean you have to have the capacity to listen to people and be genuinely interested in them. You mustn't patronize them. You must have the skill to be absolutely enchanted by what people tell you about their lives. If you are enchanted, you will find that they will tell you more because they know you're interested. Yeah. If you pretend that you're interested and you're just filling out a form and just filling out with minimum amounts of information, they can see that and they won't tell you the things that you need to know. And what you need to know are the things that are not obvious, which is what I alluded to in the nature of research. They tell you things about how some particular workplace really functions as against how it ought to function, how relationships between organizations are producing products for each other, how they really, what is their real characteristic, what's the give and take. They tell you those sorts of things, and that's what you need if you want to kind of create innovations which makes a difference. And then I think the last thing you want is modesty, because you have to be modest enough to know that although you can come up with solutions, your solutions are never going to solve all problems. But if you're modest about it, you can come up with good, robust solutions. But if you're not modest and you're too ambitious, you come up with solutions which are too complex, too clunky, and are never going to work. So you kind of need modesty so as to be realistic about what you can do, even though you put a lot of effort into it, a lot of desk work and a lot of human work. But, and then underscoring all of it, you need to be enthusiastic about what you're doing, because even though it might seem modest, your enthusiasm is going to be part and parcel of what makes people enthusiastic for your ideas. So if you're enthusiastic, you will persuade people through your enthusiasm that what you've researched, what you've understood by your human work is valid. And if you're not enthusiastic, if you don't have that kind of joie de vivre about your ideas, people themselves won't try them. They'll just think, oh, it's just another idea. And one of the things you will learn as you get to be my age is there's lots of people offering ideas. And the part of the problem in good research is getting good ideas noticed. And one of the ways that ideas get noticed is because of the enthusiasm with which they are described and explained and advocated. And that's also bound up with the need for those ideas to be appropriate for the task that they're trying to help create some innovation in. Persistence and determinations, because one of the things you find when you create some innovation is that you might create an innovation, you might get something patented, you might get something engineered, and then you might get, say, a third-party organization to be very interested in taking up your concept. But then when you start working with that third-party organization, another organization, they see things slightly differently. And then they, too, have their own customers, and they see things slightly differently. And each time you go through those sort of different places, first your own company, then another company, then, say, customers, from the, how your thing is understood shifts, and you have to adjust to that and yet persistently explain what you think the value of your proposition is. And sometimes it feels as if you're constantly doing that, and you've been doing it for months and months to a different audience, and each audience seems to come with slightly different perspectives. And what you learn is that the world's enormous and large, and that so many people are doing so many different things, that to try and explain what you're about requires like a long footpath of explaining to different people and different communities sort of the same thing, but speaking to their concerns and their aspirations and their perspectives each time. And that requires patience. And it also reminds you that the world is big, and there are a lot of people doing a lot of slightly different things. And when you work with lots of different people, each of those different things add up to quite big differences sometimes.
As you reflect back, what are your lessons learned, the pitfalls to avoid, and keys to success that you can share with aspiring researchers?
Several things. One set of things to do with the ideas themselves, the kind of innovations you have, and the other set of concerns have to do with who you're working with. If you focus on, say, the ideas you're working with, the innovations you want to develop, you really have to keep them simple. And the reason why you have to keep them simple is because it's only by keeping them simple can you explain them to people who might be investing, or people who might want to test them, or people who might want to develop them. And you have to resist making ideas seem better by making them more complicated. You need to resist making ideas seem more powerful by adding features. You need to resist so that they can be clear enough that they understood, and so that they can be clear enough to be properly tested. Now, having been properly tested and discover they succeed or not, then you might want to combine them with other ideas. But if you bundle one idea with two or three or four other ideas, it's really difficult to know what ideas are valuable and which ones aren't. So you need to kind of disentangle, to avoid entangling ideas for innovation, to make sure so as to better understand where there is success or there isn't. And at the same time as that, the other thing is working with people. And one of the things I've learned is you can only work with the people that you are working with in your team. So if you've got a really good hardware engineer, you can build some interesting hardware. If you don't have a really good hardware engineer, don't try and innovate some hardware. It's just not going to work. If you have a good team of software engineers who can deliver tested code for products, you're probably going to struggle to do something innovative and lightweight and quick, because they're not used to that sort of developing of code for concepts that need to be tested and iterated and changed quickly in a kind of agile way. But then on the other hand, if you're working with a team of coders who are used to a very agile approach to coding, you're probably going to build something which might break regularly. But that doesn't matter if you're just testing it. But it does matter if the kind of thing that you're wanting to engineer is something which requires robustness. So you have to figure out who you're working with, what skills you have, what skills your team has, to shape the things you're trying to innovate in. Because if you don't have them fitting, if they don't fit together, you're not going to succeed. Now, this is also an opportunity, because you in organizations and in the workplace, you change teams, you know, you move on, you get different teams. And then being aware of the team helps you make plans about what you want to do next in your kind of career for innovation and creativity. But at the same time, also, you should realize you should never be disappointed with your colleagues, because your colleagues are always the most brilliant people in your working life. It's not you, it's them. So you have to understand them and work with their skills as they're working with yours, and think of yourselves as a kind of like an animal, and that some animals are good at this and another animal's good at that. And the fact that you can get things done, different sorts of things, is fabulous, but you have to understand that when you're trying to think about the things you can successfully innovate with.
Passion is energy, and energy is contagious. Compelling visions draw people in. High-performing, productive teams embrace diversity and difference and are often self-organizing in that the performance emerges from the experts' joint actions within the project. They share a vision and commitment to the mission at hand. Most innovative teams mobilize themselves in response to unexpected changes. They don't need a leader to tell them what to do. People who have the expertise and passion will step up at the right time within the creative process to lead and drive the completion of their respective input and add value to the team and the solution. The creative atmosphere cultivated provides autonomy and space, is liberal, inclusive, and meritocratic, yet is entirely focused and motivated to expedite the mission. No hierarchy, politics, prejudice, and hangers-on are permitted or tolerated within that system. And it starts with a big idea and a shared vision. Then the team works through the details to come up with the big picture and then bring it to life. Tilting forward, what is your vision for the future of research and what role will creativity play within that?
I was thinking a little bit about the problem of artificial intelligence and the problem of categories and the trouble with the AI researchers is they're trying to replicate and better what people do, whereas then they're not thinking about what different things AI could do. And I think the future of research is derived from a key skill, and the key skill is not to look backwards. And by that, I mean the AI researchers are currently looking backwards at what Turing was talking about in terms of copying people. And what AI researchers should be doing is trying to look forward into a different future. And in that different future, to try and see things which are interesting and worth exploring because they're so radically different and unexpected. But looking forward into an unknown future can sometimes be give you a sense of vertigo because you're not sure what you're looking at. You're not sure what you're going to find, whereas looking backward is backwards into the past, into old premises, old categories, well-trod paths, is much easier to do. And this is not just a problem for AI research. This has always been a problem in technology research. And there are sorts of there can often be paradoxes here. So sometimes you have to look at the past differently so as to see what the future might be. So for example, at Xerox, a key development for Xerox was not just developing the WIMP interface, the Windows icon, mouse and pointer and so forth all those years ago. It was also trying to think about what paper did and what roles paper had. And on that basis, pushing that further, what you could do with documents which are digital. And now today too, as we look into a different future, perhaps we might look into the past with different eyes to see things which haven't seemed necessarily as interesting as they might be in terms of the kind of tools that people use and people have not been able to use, so as to invent new ones. So I think the problem for the future of research is looking into the future and not being too tempted to look to the past. Here's an example of the problem of categories and innovation in a home space. So one of the things you might say about Amazon's Alexa and its related services, it's a lovely way of exercising artificial intelligence and natural language processing. So you can speak to a computer, in this case, speak to a search engine, and the search engine will deliver content for you. But what's actually happening there is that a speech-based search engine does something which is natural in speech. And that is, when you're speaking to someone, you have to wait for the other person's turn to finish before you take your turn. And one consequence of that is that people get really impatient if someone else takes too long. So if you ask someone to do some search for you and then start listing all the things that they've found, or an ordinary conversation, after two or three items have been listed, the person doing the listening gets a bit irritated and says, okay, I'll the first one. I don't want to listen to 10. I haven't got time to. And so what's happening with Amazon Alexa is that the search engine, because it's voice-based, is delivering search targets, which are nearly always the ones that are listened to are the first, second, or third. And that advantages Amazon because it sells those first, second, third hits in its search engine. Now, if you have a search engine which is on a screen and a search engine presents an array of search targets, you can see those search targets. You can see many more than you can hear. Or rather, you can see much more quickly many more than you can hear. So one of the things that's happening there is that the category of shifting from seeing things I might choose from hearing things that I might choose is resulting in Amazon reducing the choices that people make in the and home and choosing things that basically Amazon chooses for them, the first, second, or third target. And this all results from people thinking that speech is the same category as looking or seeing, that reading is the same as hearing. And they're not. They're different categories, and they have different implications for how things can get done and what people want to do and how technologies can facilitate it. And so going forward for innovation in the home, one of the things that good researchers need to be trying to do is trying to explain to people in the home and to product vendors that interaction between those different kind of categories of action, how to speak to a computer is not the same as to type to a computer or to read what a computer says. And the difference is not in the content, it's in how people act on the content. So if I speak to a computer, I want an answer quickly. If I write to a computer and expect a response, I probably want a better response because I took some time to write it. So I expect the computer to be more diligent, give me a more thorough answer. If I look at a list, I want to see more, whereas if I hear a list, I want to hear less. And I think once people realize that those sort of categorical distinctions are important, there's a great deal of innovation for the home which can transform the relationship people in the home have with companies like Amazon.
Whilst technology has enabled humanity to actualize extraordinary things, don't get mesmerized by technology and being fooled into believing that it is the answer. It is not. As former Pixar Chief Creative Officer John Lasseter accurately declared, computers don't create computer animation any more than pencils create pencil animation. What creates is the artist. The key is the intelligent application of technology to unlocking human ingenuity for the greater good by pushing society forward ethically and responsibly. Humans and machines are working together to problem solve and transform the world for the better in an age of creativity. Reject conventions, constantly analyze and question and challenge the status quo in your everyday life and provide an alternative and bring it to life. But how soon is the future? One thing for sure is, the future is unwritten and everything is possible. You have been listening to the Unknown Origins podcast. Please follow, subscribe, rate, and review us. For more information, go to unknownorigins.com. Thank you for listening.